Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio. You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello, everybody. This is Jay Shapiro. This has been a very exciting weekend for Israel for a number of reasons. Some are very good and some are not so good. So let's start with the very good. The United States Embassy was moved to Jerusalem. Jerusalem has been the capital of the State of Israel since 1949. And most states, however, including the United States, chose not to recognize Israel's capital. They located their embassies in the Tel Aviv area. There was some possibility they would recognize West Jerusalem as Israel's capital, either before or after the 1967 Six-Day War. However, the failure to recognize Israel's capital is a unique diplomatic anomaly. In election campaigns, successive American presidents have been promising to transfer the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem since Congress passed a law saying that Jerusalem is recognized as the capital of Israel. But they failed to live up to that commitment. Congress demanded recognition and transfer, but to no avail. President Donald Trump dramatically changed this pattern by recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital and ordering that the U.S. Embassy be moved here. So there was a celebration this week. Streets were covered with American flags, and the U.S. delegation included about 150 persons. The excitement was tangible, and it was heartening and emotional. The Jewish people returned to its historic capital after two millennia of an exile that was not always pleasant. It included pogroms and crusades and expulsions. But we have returned. Abba Eben was wont to say that the Jewish people are the only people in the world who live in the same land, speak the same language, and worship the same God that they did 2,000 years ago. It's an exciting time to be here. On the negative side, the Palestinians are using the moving of the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem as an excuse to start a mini-war, which is taking place even as I record this program. On the border of Gaza that was given to the Palestinians in order to establish a state that they claimed they wanted, they're sending women and children as cannon fodder to break through the fences into Israel. I'll say a few words about that. So it's a week of very mixed emotions, but it's a really a very exciting time to be here. I'll be back after the break and we'll discuss some of this in detail.
John O'Vandor.
And I'm Ross Nichols.
Join us on our program, Israel on My Mind, a show that broadcasts all the weekly goodness that flows like milk and honey from the Holy Land straight into your ears with humorous and happy news stories.
We're going to be talking about...
What are we going to talk about?
A person who takes out a terrorist with a pizza tray.
And there's Donald Trump talking to a turkey. What's that about?
A 71-year-old rock star is a staunch supporter of Israel.
Join us on our program, Israel on My Mind.
Every Thursday.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello again, everybody. For thousands of years, the Jewish people has had a period of time called the High Holidays. In Hebrew, it's called Yomim Noraim, which means days of awe. This is the period that starts on the new year, which is the first day of the Hebrew month of Tishrei, which comes out in the fall, generally in September or October. This is a two-day holy day, which is followed by 10 days later by Yom Kippur, which is the Day of Atonement on the 10th day of the month of Tishrei. This is followed by the holiday of Sukkot, or Tabernacles, which starts on the 15th day of Tishrei, and this is followed by Shmini Atzeret, or the Day of Solemn Assembly, which is the 22nd day of Tishrei. So, from the 1st of Tishrei until the 22nd day of Tishrei, a period of 3 weeks, we have the Holy Day period. It is essentially 3 weeks long, but now we have a new period, which is being called by some the Israeli High Holidays. It begins on the traditional biblical holiday of Passover on the 15th day of Nisan, which is in the springtime. Then it includes Holocaust Remembrance Day, then Memorial Day for those who have fallen in the defense and the creation of the State of Israel, which includes both military and civilian deaths and includes the period starting with the beginning of the Zionist enterprise at the end of the 19th century. Then there's Israel Independence Day, which is celebrated according to the Hebrew calendar, the fifth day of the month of Iyar. And until this year, it ended on the 28th day of Iyar, which is the day that Jerusalem was united under Jewish sovereignty in the Six-Day War back in 1967. This year, the 28th of Iyar, Jerusalem Day, came out on Sunday the 13th of May, the beginning of this week. But this year, a new day of celebration was added. On the day after Jerusalem Day, the U.S. Embassy was officially opened in Jerusalem in a very impressive ceremony. So the Israeli high holidays have become one day longer. I don't know whether the annual celebration of the move of the American Embassy to Israel's capital will be held on the secular day, May 14th, or on the Hebrew day, the 29th of Iyar. I suppose the powers in charge will decide. But in any event, it is a really great and emotional day. The American Embassy is about a mile from where I live. Now, a united Jerusalem under Israeli sovereignty is the key to peace and security in the city. Dividing up Jerusalem would be patently unwise, exceedingly unfair to Jewish history, and an insult to Israel's fine control and stewardship of the city. I want to give reasons why. First of all, full Israeli control over Greater Jerusalem is the linchpin for the country's grand security posture. Jerusalem anchors the critical west-east axis in the coastal plain from the Mediterranean River to the Jordan River. Israel's long-term hold of the strategic arc from Jaffa near Tel Aviv to Jericho necessitates Israeli dominance in and around Jerusalem. This should be buttressed by settlement in an area known as E1, which is directly east of the city, and expansion of a community that exists already called Male Adumim, east of the city, and the reinforcement of Israel's military and civilian presence maintaining a defensible border in the Jordan Valley. This is quite important. That's one reason. Another reason, in dividing of the city into Arab and Jewish sovereignties would turn Jerusalem into what's happening in Belfast in Ireland at its worst. Any section under Palestinian sovereignty will become ground zero for the fierce wars being raged within the Arab world and would become a basis of attack on Israel, as is now happening from the Gaza Strip. So a partitioned Jerusalem will lead to violence that will really suck the lifeblood from the city in every way, culturally, religiously, economically, in every way. Another reason is that the truth is that for the past 50 years, Israel has managed the complicated city with sophistication and sensitivity. Israel has developed this city from a backwater town to a really great international capital city, sparkling with energy and creativity, and it's open to all. It's a fantastic place to live. Israel has developed Jerusalem as an attractive city because it cares, because Jerusalem is a historic centerpiece of Jewish peoplehood. The Arabs and the Palestinians don't really care about Jerusalem. They never have. It's the third most holy city in their religion. In fact, they would consider a victory if Jerusalem were so racked by conflict and poverty that it would be ruined for 1,000 years, just as long as the Jews wouldn't have it. Another reason is that effective rule is going to require massive investment by the Israeli government. There's no two ways about it. And also by the Jerusalem municipality, because eastern Jerusalem, where the Arabs live, have been neglected for decades, and it's partly the fault of Israel. Only a generous Israeli approach can overcome the suspicion and hostility that leads to security problems. The good news is that there are about 350,000 Arabs living in East Jerusalem, and they increasingly understand that they'll always be better off under Israeli administration, and they're slowly integrating. Go anywhere you want to go. In particular, I recommend anybody coming to Israel, anybody listening to this program, go visit any hospital in Jerusalem. Matter of fact, visit any hospital in Israel and see how the Arabs are being cared for, exactly the same as the Jewish citizens. There is one final irony. The notion of dividing Jerusalem into two capitals with two governments has been around for decades, the so-called two-state solution. This leading Israeli governments delay and deny Eastern Jerusalem the development dollars that it needs. Really, East Jerusalem must be developed. The situation of the Arabs must be improved. After all, why should Israel invest there if one day Eastern Jerusalem may be handed over to an Arab regime, which would be a terrorist regime anyhow? Now, the Israeli government has determined that Jerusalem must and will remain under Israeli administration, and not just for security reasons. Israel has received important international backing for this. As Trump himself said, we have taken Jerusalem off the table. Israel can no longer ignore its responsibilities to develop the eastern half of the city, which has the major Arab population. By the way, Arabs work all over the city. You go into any coffee shop in Jerusalem or any restaurant, the chances are the man behind the counter will be an Arab. And it's up to us to improve them as long as we are going to contain this city, but remain under control. Our prime minister and Jerusalem's mayor, Barkat, I think he's been mayor for about 8 years, they've finally begun to invest in the welfare of Jerusalemite Arabs. Investment and good governance on a local level is the core of sovereign political action that will keep Jerusalem whole and make it prosperous for everybody. There are no two ways about it. For the last 23 years, since the Congress in the United States passed the law mandating the move of the embassy to Jerusalem, subsequent governments, subsequent administrations have balked for two main reasons, a fear that it would trigger violence and a concern that it would damage the peace process. That's been the big fear. However, these predictions of violent protests over the issue have come to nothing. They've not materialized. The violence in Gaza this week was the exception, but other than this great march of return, which I'll speak about in the next part of the program, on Tuesday's so-called Nakba Day, this violence would likely to have erupted with or without the assembly move. Which does not mean, by the way, there will not be more violent protests or terrorist actions, but the fears of an end-of-the-world outburst that caused one U.S. president after another to waive every 6 months moving the U.S. embassy because of the fear of the impact this would have on U.S. national security seems to have been very, very overstated. There's a refashioning taking place in the Middle East, not just here in Israel and the area immediately around it. As a matter of fact, Bahrain's foreign minister tweets, as he did last week, saying that Israel has a right to defend itself. It's a clear sign that things are different now in the Middle East than they've ever been before, a lot of which has to do with the fear of the Sunni Muslims, including Saudi Arabia, their fear of the Shiite Muslims, which is really the headquarters are in Iran. So the Saudi royal family and the Jordanian royal family are cuddling up to Israel, I guess, pretty much under the table, but they're all kind of hints at that because of their fear, not because of their love of Israel, but simply because of their fear of Iran. So the second reason subsequent U.S. president said he would not take the step that it would harm the peace process. There is no peace process. There was momentum once upon a time in the beginning, but it was all false. That argument now makes no sense. If the Palestinians are staying away from the peace table and insisting on their positions, even if the embassy remains on Tel Aviv, it makes no difference now that the embassy's in Jerusalem. If all goes well, a few years from now, when the embassy is an established fact and work is carried out without anyone taking notice, people will look back on the day the embassy moved, much as they look back on other days that came and went. Things will be better in the future. I'll be back after the break.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
This is Shai Ben-Tekoa. Each week I'll be webcasting to you from Judea, origin of the word Jew, a people besieged and beleaguered in every generation. Nazi Germany is but a memory, but in its place the world invented the phantom Palestinians as this generation's internationally authorized Jew killers. Tune in for a different slant on life in Israel, Phantom Nation, every Monday.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Okay, you're back with Jay Shapiro. On this segment of the program, I want to discuss the violence which is accompanying the official move of the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. There's been violence on our border with Gaza in particular. So far, more than 50 have been killed and thousands have been wounded. The true purpose of Hamas's plan, now Hamas controls the Gaza Strip, the true purpose of Hamas's plan is to incite violence in such a way that the IDF, the Israeli army, has no choice but to respond with legal force, killing Gaza civilians. As it happens, the United Nations and the European Union and human rights groups and many Western media organizations will have helped to bring this about. The UN, the EU, and a range of human rights groups and media organizations have devoted their efforts to unjustly condemning Israel's action. If there was genuine concern for human life and human rights among these people, rather than a fixation on unfairly vilifying Israel, they would harshly condemn Hamas and not Israel. The Palestinian terrorist group Hamas is orchestrating up to 200,000 people on the Gaza border starting about 2 weeks ago, and it's intent on turning it into an orgy of death and bloodshed. The UN and the EU, human rights groups, and many Western media organizations will have helped to bring it about. Hamas, which governs the Gaza Strip, is planning 6 weeks of violence along the border that so far has led to the deaths of around 50 of their own people and wounding hundreds, if not thousands, more. Now they intend to pile the bodies higher still, exploiting what they see as a perfect storm. It's the 70th anniversary of the creation of the modern state of Israel, which a date that the Palestinians called the Catastrophe Day, Nakba. It coincides with the opening of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem, and this is a move which is quite abhorrent to those who consider the existence of the Jewish state illegitimate. And also this week is the beginning of the Islamic festival of Ramadan, a time when violence throughout the Muslim world often spirals. Hamas claims that the purpose of their demonstration is to break through Israeli border en masse, march through the country, and reclaim the homes that they say people were thrown out of when Israel was formed. They are exercising what they call the right of return, but they know they cannot achieve that in the face of the formidable Israeli Defense Force. So the true purpose of Hamas's plan is to incite violence in such a way that the army, the IDF, has no choice but to respond with lethal force, killing Gaza civilians. This makes Hamas the first government in history that we know of to deliberately lure its enemies to kill its own civilian population. So the question is, why does it wish to sacrifice its people? The answer is to bring upon Israel the vilification of the Western world, to isolate and criminalize this country and cause condemnation by political leaders, by the UN, by the EU, by human rights groups, academics, and the media. All that is exactly what is happening. Hamas has followed this strategy many times in the past, firing rockets at Israeli civilian communities and constructing under the border sophisticated attack tunnels in which fighters would storm into the heart of Jewish communities and carry out mass murder and abduction if they can. Over the years, thousands of Palestinians have died, including human shields that are so central to their strategy, because our army has been compelled to forcefully defend its people. The world has often reacted with horror and outrage, blaming Israel for the bloodshed provoked by Hamas, which is just exactly what Hamas intended. If anything, Hamas's current plans are even more effective. Rockets and attack tunnels look like what they are, engines of war, but political leaders, international organizations, human rights groups, and the media, who are the primary targets of Hamas's propaganda, find it hard to understand how demonstrations, which are falsely portrayed as peaceful, like what they might see in their own cities, how can such demonstrations pose a sufficient threat to warrant the use of deadly force? The price paid in Palestinian blood of stopping border penetrations has so far been high and is likely to increase. But imagine the consequences if our army failed to stop these crowds breaking through the fence. The nearest Israeli communities are just a few minutes' dash from the border by armed terrorists intent on mass murder. In this scenario, with gunmen indistinguishable from unarmed civilians, who themselves are often posed as violent threat, it's hard to see how our army could avoid inflicting far higher casualties in defense of our territory and our people. So, to prevent this scenario from becoming reality, the IDF has adopted a graduated response. They've airdropped thousands of leaflets, and they've used SMS, social media, phone calls, and radio broadcasts to warn the people of Gaza not to gather at the border. They even contacted a Gaza bus company, asking them not to transport people to the border. When these appeals were nullified by Hamas's coercion of the civil population, the IDF used tear gas to disperse the crowds that approached the fence. Next, they fired warning shots overhead. Finally, only when absolutely necessary and lawful, they used ball ammunition aimed to disable rather than kill. Several people died as a result of this gunfire. Many more were wounded. Of the 50 people Palestinian authorities claim were killed up to now, Israel assesses 80% were terrorist operatives or individuals associated with them. Many armchair experts argue that Israel should have acted differently, but there has not one group can credibly explain how they could have acted differently. Instead, the UN, the EU, and a range of human rights groups and media organizations have devoted their efforts to unjustly condemning Israel's actions. If there was a genuine concern for human life and human rights among these people, all these organizations, all these media, rather than a fixation on unfairly vilifying Israel, they would harshly condemn Hamas. Instead, their criticism of Israel plays directly into Hamas's hands and validates the use of human shields and a strategy of forcing the killing of their own civilian. Hamas's use of smoke and mirrors to conceal its aggressive maneuvering on the Gaza border is a perfect metaphor for a strategy that has no viable military purpose, but only seeks to deceive the international community into criminalizing a democratic state like Israel, which is defending its citizens. All these organizations, the UN, the European Union, NGOs, government officials, and media, have been willingly taken in. For example, the Guardian in London, the headline said the use of lethal force to cow nonviolent demonstrations by Palestinians blatantly misrepresents the violent reality that has been plain for all to see. Likewise, the NGO Human Rights Watch claims we are seeing a movement to affirm Palestinians' internationally recognized right of return. In reality, these demonstrations are far from peaceful, do not pursue any so-called right of return. Rather, they are carefully planned and orchestrated military operations intended to break through a border of a sovereign state and commit mass murder in the communities near the border, using their own civilians as cover. What the purpose is to criminalize and isolate the state of Israel. Since the 30th of March, Hamas has been orchestrating large-scale violence on the border between Gaza and Israel. These major flare-ups have generally occurred on Friday following the prayers in the mosque. There's been concerted action involving crowds up to 40,000 people at a time in five separate areas along the border. Violence and aggressive actions, including specific acts of terrorism involving explosives and firearms, have also occurred at other times. In addition to the border area, there are Palestinian plans for significant violence elsewhere around this time, including Jerusalem and the West Bank. Although the 15th of May was originally intended as the culmination of 6 weeks of violence on the Gaza border, Palestinians have recently declared an intent to maintain their aggression at the border throughout the month of Ramadan, which begins this week. So this violence has been orchestrated under the pretext of a great march of return, a demonstration to draw attention to a Palestinian leadership committed to be the right of return of their people to homes in Israel. The stated intention is not just to demonstrate, but actually break through the border fence en masse and physically march in their thousands, at least through those Jewish communities on the border. The real goal of Hamas's violence is to continue their long-standing strategy of international outrage, creating international outrage, vilification, isolation, and criminalization of the State of Israel. This strategy includes creating situations which compel our army to respond with lethal force if they are seen to kill and wound innocent Palestinian civilians. So they use women, children, who either forced or volunteered to prevent themselves near the border, where fighters and combat supplies and munitions are located. So the Israeli military response will include potential harm to civilians. This is something that Hamas has planned to do. They're doing it big time now, especially starting a couple of weeks ago. I assume they started planning this in December when President Trump announced he's going to move the American embassy to Jerusalem. So it's a new strategy. It's new tactics, and it's something which is being very effective because the media around the world are quick to take up the position presented by Hamas. Their tactics are planned, orchestrated, really military operation, and it is a very serious problem, and we're right in the midst of it now. I wanted the listeners to be aware of what's happening. I'll be back after the break.
Everyone, this is Andrea Simento from Jerusalem, inviting you to drop everything and join me on my show, Pull Up a Chair. We'll visit this week's quirky stories, meet fabulous guests, and discover my Israel. Together, we'll laugh, shout, and explain the topics that make us say, hey, we've got to talk about that. So get comfortable and pull up a chair with me, Andrea Simento, every Thursday on Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. As I am recording this program, a mini war is taking place on our border with Gaza. Hamas, which controls Gaza, is sending thousands of Arabs, including women and children, to the border in an attempt to enable some of them to break through and kill Israelis who live close to the border. There are all kinds of eyewitness reports on how Hamas is using civilians to try to overcome the Israeli defensives. To get a picture, it's enough to read the headlines without going into the details. The headlines read like, two Gazans killed, 100 injured in border riots, Palestinian crowd given an order or signal, and thousands of them started sprinting and streaming along the border. Smoke from fires, burning tires, Molotov cocktails, kites and fire kites sailed across the border to burn fields. Smoke blended in with tear gas. Keep in mind that the goal of these riots is not to achieve a Palestinian state. It is simply to kill Jews. This is the main purpose, but there is another one. The idea is to have Palestinian civilians killed by the Israeli soldiers so that the world can see how cruel Israel is. And this second goal seems to be working. So the Palestinian leadership doesn't care how many Palestinians are killed so that they can gain a public relations win. That is what's happening this week, and it's happening even as I'm recording this program. Now, for some reason, there are still people talking about a two-state solution. Keep in mind that Hamas kicked the Palestinian Authority out of Gaza violently 15 years ago, so that there are two separate Palestinian entities, both of whom are violent, but one of which, the Palestinian Authority, pretends to be interested in setting up a Palestinian state. After almost three decades of getting billions of dollars from the United States and Europe, the Palestinian Authority has not even taken the first step to set up the required infrastructure for a functioning state. The two-state solution was stillborn, but there's those who still pushing the idea. Recently, I read an interview with one of the few people who is willing to analyze and say what is really required for a two-state solution, but even he doesn't touch upon one of the most fundamental problems. I'm speaking about Douglas Feith, who is a who was the Undersecretary of Policy in the U.S. Defense Department during the George Bush administration. And he helped devise U.S. government's response to the 9/11 attacks. When asked recently what he thinks about the two-state solution, he noted that it's rooted in the Oslo process. A key problem with it, according to Feith, is the assumption that peace can be negotiated with today's leaders of the Palestinian Authority. But that leadership has all the flaws, the dishonesty, the corruption, and violence, which is inherent in the Oslo process. He goes on to say, and I'm repeating this because it's important, in multiple ways, the people who run the Palestinian Authority are paid richly to perpetuate the conflict. All the aid, attention, sympathy, and honor that the world bestows on them hinges on their role as leaders of the fight against Israel for what they call justice. If they agree to terminate the conflict, they would not only put their personal security at risk, but most likely lose everything in life that they value materially and morally. Now, Feith believes this helps explain the failure of the extraordinary forthcoming peace proposal of Prime Minister Ehud Barak to Arafat in 2000. Instead of accepting, Arafat insisted on one additional concession, the right of return, which even leaders of Israel's so-called peace camp described as a demand for Israel's suicide. After rejecting Barak's offer, Arafat launched a second intifada that killed 2,000 Israelis and wounded tens of thousands. Feith explains that Ehud Olmert's open-handed peace proposal to the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas in 2008 failed. Evidently, Mahmoud Abbas calculated he couldn't afford to agree to terminate the conflict, which remains the case today. Anyone hoping to promoting peace should start by acknowledging the disappointing reality that the current Palestinian leadership cannot be expected to end the conflict. The only serious way to increase the chances for peace is to develop a long-term strategy to change the economic and political circumstances of Palestinian society so that a leadership with different interests and incentives can arise. This requires, according to Feith, vision and patience. He advises that if foreigners are going to provide aid, they should do so in ways that empower good people, not the current leaders. The aid shouldn't continue to flow if it's used to pay terrorists or their families. Controls should be established so that political leaders don't steal the aid. The goal should be to use the aid to give children a proper education and to improve the health and material well-being of the population generally. The Palestinian society suffers from too much violence and corruption, lack of democratic institution, overdependence on government handouts, lack of economic productivity, and last but not least, debilitating and anti-Israel indoctrination of children and adults. The ultimate purpose of any foreign aid provided to the Palestinians should be to promote a new culture. Without that, new and better leaders won't arise. Without such leaders, there'll be no peace with Israel. Now, this sounds very logical, what Douglas Feith is contending, except there's one problem. You see, since the Oslo Agreement, both the educational system in the Palestinian Authority and the sermons that are preached every day, and especially every Friday in the mosque, has raised two and almost three generations of Palestinians who are simply brainwashed to believe that the state of Israel has no right to exist and the Jews have no right to life. So the question is, who would be the new, if you kicked out all the present leadership, which is, corrupt, and has done nothing, has created no foundation for a Palestinian state since the Oslo Agreement, who would you replace them with? This is sort of a hole in the logic, a failure in the logic of people like Douglas Feith, who point out how bad things are now and why it got that way. The problem is, how do you correct this by a new leadership if there is no new leadership? The people today who started kindergarten in 1993 or 1994 are the generation who could be the new leadership, but they've been brainwashed. The Palestinians in the territories live largely on foreign aid as employees of the Palestinian Authority government, which is not healthy for their society. In other words, even the adults in the Palestinian Authority have been living off the fruits of the rottenness and the corruption of the Palestinian Authority. In other words, there is no new generation that can take over. They continue to claim entitlement, which is interesting because the world is full of countries that could put forward territorial claims that conflict with those of their neighbors. Yet most of these countries around the world, when they have conflict, most live in peace with their neighbors because they're realistic. And Zionist leaders time and again took the position that they're willing to accept the best deal available, even if they had to trade away some claims to obtain it. The Zionist leaders didn't focus on what they called justice in the abstract, and they didn't teach their children that political compromise is dishonorable. So you have two generations of Palestinian raised to believe that political compromise is dishonorable. So how could they possibly replace the present leadership? The Palestinians are locked into a political culture dominated by an ideology rooted in an inflexible religious and nationalistic principles that preclude peace with Israel. This culture is not serving the best interests of the Palestinians. It's not serving the interests of the countries that are donating billions of dollars to the Palestinians. And it goes without saying that it's not serving Israel's interests. The only way there can be peace, according to people like Feith, is that the culture changes. New Palestinian leaders might be able to make the changes, and outside powers might be able to use their influence to bring about such changes. But where is this new Palestinian leadership to come from? It's going to come from the generation raised to believe that the state of Israel has no right to exist and injured individual Jews have no right to life. So even with all the goodwill an understanding about the lack of the stillborn nature of the peace process, there is simply nobody to replace the present leadership, and there won't be anybody until they change the educational system and the way they preach in the mosque, and that'll take another two generations. So we're up against a very serious problem. A lot of people, simply even good, well-meaning people, don't realize the nature of this problem. This is very sad, but these are the facts. I hope things will be better this week. This is Jay Shapiro signing off. And again, let's hope and pray for better news next week.
Hey, this is Jake in Anchorage, Alaska, and I love listening to all the super interesting interviews and up-to-date information on what's happening in Israel.
Hello, this is Anna King, originally from London, now living in Israel. And what can I say? Israel News Talk Radio is my cup of tea.
My name is Bhaskar. I'm from India, and I love listening because you get to know the truth and wonderful voices from this lovely country.
Mom!
Okay, wait a minute.
Hi, this is Chava Dax, and I'm calling from the rolling hills of Maale Adumim, just north of Jerusalem. I always listen to Israel News Talk Radio to get all the latest news and commentary and to keep me up to date every day.
This is Sarah Dax from Maale Adumim, and I'm 12. I wish Israel News Talk Radio was boring so my mom wouldn't listen to it all the time. Mom!
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
News, opinion, and more. You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.